Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today I have the great pleasure of introducing a young man, Cole Lepoli. I met him, I think, when he was a teenager, courtesy of his father that I became friends with actually at the athletic club that I used to belong to. Cole has graciously been willing to come on the podcast to talk about his issues with being diagnosed as bipolar.
Dr. Dana Saperstein and the Fear Me Out podcast is pleased to announce that Janus Community Counseling Services is now the proud sponsor of the Fear Me Out podcast. Janus Community Counseling Services is a nonprofit organization in Santa Barbara, California, that is committed to providing professional, affordable counseling. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to the podcast. For more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.
So, Cole, I can't tell you how appreciative I am, and I think that what you have to say is extremely important, and I think that my audience will receive you quite well. So if you don't mind, can you introduce yourself a bit and let's start in as early in your life as possible about who you are and where you come from, and we'll go from there.
I'd just like to first off thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about something that I can find in society to be highly masked and veiled. There's taboos and stigmas. You have personalities on TV. You have things on the movie screen, books. But to actually live the experience and have that subjective experience. But I think to actually live it is very different from reading about it in a book. And if you'd read a book on France, it's not the same as going to France and eating exactly baguettes and enjoying the steak tartare and seeing the cathedrals there. You might see pictures, but it's different to feel the walls and to have made those buildings yourself.
Absolutely.
And so it's an honor and a privilege, and I look forward to us having a thoroughly engaging dialogue in which we can both be as deep and honest, and I'm grateful for this platform.
Well, so thanks.
I can start off, sure. I was born in Long Island, New York, at Jewish Memorial Hospital in New Hyde Park. My father was an attorney and did real estate amongst being an inventor. And my mother was a marketing executive at a Fortune 500 company before they had me. My mother was kind enough to raise me and take a step away from her work. And we moved to Santa Barbara, California after my father desired to not have to deal with another winter in New York. And I think given my grandfather was an off the boat immigrant, he showed up in, I believe, 1912, first of nine. They showed up with no shoes and no understanding of English.
Wow.
And my grandfather sold watermelons. He broke horses. He drove trucks. He found wood outside the Empire State Building that they were getting rid of and found places to build with it and sell it. He was the ultimate hardworking immigrant with a vision for the future and a belief that America was a place in which you could really do anything with yourself. And he ended up being quite successful. So my full name is Colden Peter Nicholas Lepoli III. And so I'm the third Peter.
Okay.
And it's something I have an incredible amount of honor and respect for. I think with that name comes duty and obligation, not just to my family, but to be the type of person my grandfather was.
And which part of Europe did he come from?
He came from Naples.
Okay.
Napoli. He was Neapolitan.
Right.
He passed away when I was 10, but I used to drive around with him in a town car. He loved town cars and Cadillacs, everything American.
Old school.
Very old school Italian. He always used to say, do favors for everybody. Because when he was young, he would do favors for everyone. And maybe, it wasn't in his mind, he said, but maybe one time he needed something, he could call on that person, say, hey, I used to deliver soup to your mom. Remember when your car broke down, I came over with the cables. Your cousin used to come to our car lot. Did I ever do him wrong? Not because you rely on the kindness of others, but at the end of the day, you sometimes have to rely on the kindness of others to make it through. And there's a part of my story that will hit upon how important it was in my life that a couple people showed up when I was struggling.
Okay. And so how old were you when your family came to Santa Barbara?
I was two.
Oh, so you were very little.
I was very little, but it was interesting. You know, we lived in California growing up, but then in the summers, we'd be in the Hamptons at my grandfather's beach house. He built with his bare hands. We have a place in the Hampton Bays, which is always the ethnic part of the Hampton Bays. That's not Southampton. It's not West Hampton. So if people want to be derogatory, they could say that. Oh, you're not really in the Hamptons. You're in the Hampton Bays. But honestly, we had a little dock, a tiny little boat. We'd go fishing. The birds would drop clams onto our asphalt outside our home. My father's sculptures were there. It's a very humble house.
Wow.
But I always thought fondly is that being the congregating space for the Honorados, which is my cousin, and the Lupolis. And so I have that sharp-elbowed New York City fight for it kind of mentality, hearing all the stories of my grandfather and the properties we run in Queens, own and manage. And then I have that, hey, chill, California, let's go surf. Yeah, man.
It's quite a combo.
It is. It is. And it's an interesting amalgam through which you experience life, where one is very direct in New York and the other is more circumambulant, I think is the term.
Sure.
Roundabout. It's not as direct. If someone doesn't like you, they probably won't say it right away. Whereas in New York, they're much more to the point.
Right. Was your mom East Coast also? Or
my mother was born in Santa Fe, excuse me, Albuquerque.
Oh, okay.
And then her father, my grandfather, grandpa, Glenn, he moved the family to Palo Alto.
Oh,
so she was raised in Palo Alto in the early 60s. And then by about 68, they were in the Applegate. So, and they had a big ranch that, because my grandparents were, they funded the Freedom Riders.
Oh. They
were very active in their church, and they wanted to have a summer camp where kids could learn how to ride horses, cattle cutting. My uncle's a professional cattle cutter.
Wow.
I don't know if you know what that is. Do you?
You know, it's a really remarkable combination.
It is. So it's this sort of 60s Palo Alto, San Francisco, and then you have my father who was living in the 60s and 70s. In New York City,
exactly,
which is a very interesting city at that time. It was much more cutthroat and violent.
Not very safe, actually.
Right. You had a lot of different eras there, but none of them were decadent necessarily. It was Park Avenue. Look, the Upper East Side, the Upper West Side, I think, was always that way. But there was a lot of, you know, you couldn't really want to go to the Bowery. You didn't want to go to Alphabet City. You did not want to go to the meatpacking. Soho was divey and... but also highly cultured. So I have these two very, I have a very left brain influence with my father and a very right brain influence with my mother. Not so much creativity, but the nurturing was very present. Whereas with my father, I always felt like we were best friends, but we were also business partners because I was raised in the, he'd bring me into the negotiating rooms as a child and have me sit there and he'd be, just let me watch.
Wow. So what was your life like growing up in Santa Barbara? Was it relatively okay?
It was idyllic. I think Crane School provided an amazing playground to inspire me to learn and grow and really love learning. I think I could tell you all of my teachers' names going all the way back. Miss Beacon was science. Mr. Ingersoll was social studies. Mr. McCaslin was world religions. Mr. Von Poole sadly passed. We got him a nice gift right before he died because he had cancer. He knew he was dying. So we all jumped in and my class did. Michael Bagdasarian took the lead on that, who was one of my classmates, very cool artist. Those were my role models, and that was my community, and I was so lucky to be so inspired by the various professors, and that carried on. I always wanted the freedom and the breadth and depth that came with a grand education, and I knew where it could take me and propel me if I stayed dedicated to my academic pursuits, and it did land me at Cornell. I worked really hard in high school while maintaining a social life. And I'll be honest, I think the only traumatic parts of my childhood that I would speak of was my parents' divorce in eighth grade.
Okay.
Which was really a separation. The divorce was finalized when I was about 20.
Oh.
So that can be an interesting conundrum for a child.
Oh, sure.
Because it's separation, but it's not official separation.
And were you aware of the struggles they were going through?
You know, something that was very difficult for me in which it took me years to get over it. But my mother told me when I was in fifth grade, the story about my grandparents on her side, Grammy and Grandpa, you know, there was Grammy, Grandpa, and then Grandma. Grandma was my grandfather's, Glenn's, second wife.
Oh.
And so she told me the story of what happened between them, and my grandfather left my grandmother for his son's best friend's mom.
Oh, man.
They had an affair, and it separated the family, and it happened when my mom was in college. So she made it through and then was living her own life when she heard about it, which I imagine was advantageous for her psyche, having her own life.
Right. Not
growing up in a divorced household. But my mom told me when we were in Italy vacationing, after she told me that story, she said, well, we'll never be like that, I promise. And I really believed her.
Okay.
I'd like really believe that my mom was, I think most kids do, they believe that their parents are infallible.
Right.
And so the day that my parents sat us down, I remember it vividly. I thought I was in trouble.
Oh.
I went, oh no, what did I do? Genuinely.
Yeah, sure.
And they pretty much said, as you know, we've been having struggles. I didn't know. I thought my father slept on the couch by preference.
Oh, okay.
I thought that's what dads did, because I'd snuggle with him at night. We'd watch movies before we went to sleep, but he'd lived on the couch for a while. But it didn't seem odd. Honestly, looking back, I'd imagine it's hard if you're in a house and you're sleeping on the couch. There was that physical separation. They didn't go out to eat. Like,
did you ever find out what really took their marriage apart?
I think they were just very different people. If you asked me, how did they meet and find true love? I think you sometimes find a soulmate, but you grow apart.
Oh, okay.
And the things that maybe bothered you with that person, you put aside because you're so profoundly connected to that person.
And so there was a time you felt your parents deeply connected to each other before they got a separation?
I don't know if I ever felt an emotional connection between my parents.
Oh, okay.
It's not something I'd really thought of. It was more as though we're a family, we're a unit.
Oh, okay.
We do things together. Mom and dad make decisions together. And then my father was essentially moved to the guest house that day. And I just remember, you know, the song, the day the music died. That's how it felt.
Oh,
the day
okay.
the music died.
Did you experience any sort of emotional difficulty before that time?
No, I'd lived in Italy for a year following the passing of my grandfather. Given what he did for our family, he was the patriarch. My father wanted us to understand Italian culture, and it was a beautiful and difficult experience. Not speaking the language and living in Tuscany in a beach resort during the summer was happening.
Wow.
You know, it was beautiful. I Montana Massacrati, which are the Carrara mountain range, is where the David came from, the Pietà, some of the most famous marble. I apprenticed under two different marble sculptures. I joined a biking club at the bike shop. I went surfing in the Mediterranean. It was ideal, but I also went to public Italian school, which was profoundly isolating and challenging.
I bet.
So going from Crane school, which was beautiful, and I had friends, activities 24/7, I ended up spending a lot of time just riding my bike around town or riding up into the mountains, and I had very little supervision there, if any.
And you were what, 16, 17?
I was 13.
Oh, 13. Young.
I could really go anywhere and do anything.
Wow.
And get lost. Find a cathedral at the top of the mountain and with my buddy climb up through the woods, not even on a trail, to the top of the cathedral where there were some abandoned houses all over town, villas, and we'd sneak into them and see Time magazine articles from the 40s. And they were like little time capsules. And it was amazing and beautiful. I mean, I sculpted marble with two incredible people, John Fisher. I'm an American who moved to Pietrasanta. I mean, there were Botteros in the city square. It's where all the Art de Giannis are. The Art de Giannis are the artisans who work under the marble sculptors. That's where their studios are.
Oh, okay.
And we traveled Europe together. We went to Croatia and Slovakia, Hungary, London. We traveled to the Boot. We traveled to Sicily. And I was grateful to be exposed to and frankly privileged in a way to see so many facets of Europe and have the experience of being in a different country and really trying to inhabit all the elements that comprise it. So anyways, my parents' relationship, I think, was challenged during that period of time because they didn't have as many friends to go spend time with.
Oh, okay.
And they were around each other much more than they were prior. So potentially the mechanisms through which they coped with domestic disturbances with regard to just dissimilar opinions flourished. And as a result, I think upon returning, they thought just it didn't work. And I don't think either of them wanted it, because who wants your marriage to fall apart when you have kids?
Right.
But I don't know if they were aware of the extent to which it impacted me. And so that day, I punched out a glass painting, picture of my family together. It was a very formal family photo hanging. I just punched it out with my fist, didn't cut my hands, and then went to my room and cried, because I knew it was never going to be a family. There was never going to be a family dinner again.
Right.
And there wasn't. And I think there was part of myself that believed in my parents, specifically my mom. I'd always sided with my father just because we were business partners. That's what I hope to do one day, is our family real estate. And I felt very connected to New York City. I never felt connected, at least at that time, to my cowboy roots. That didn't speak to me like the city, because I always wanted to expand our real estate. That's what I, that was my passion, because my grandfather did so much for us. I always wanted to take that beautiful object that he was so willing to kill himself over.
Yeah.
I mean, worked every single day until he was dead, pretty much.
Wow.
I didn't want to ever shuck the responsibility and the obligation that comes with being gifted such an amazing opportunity.
It's remarkable.
So nevertheless, my parents separated. They were very kind as to let us be at whatever house we wanted. My father, and this actually does play into the diagnosis, because there was a certain amount of, I didn't speak to it, I can finish on that. There was a certain amount of emotional vulnerability that I had prior to that. And it felt like my innocence and my desire to feel I gave away in that moment, because it was so hurtful what happened. And so I didn't have as much of an emotional capacity through high school, and worked really hard to get into the best school humanly possible so I could leave my family situation that was bringing me so much turmoil.
So you actively, actually consciously decided it was best to get away from the situation.
And be free, because I knew with a great education and that type of network, I would never have to rely, or because it just turned into dad pays for this, mom pays for that, squabbles over, and nothing against them, it was just true. Squabbles over who's at whose house, minor and subtle, but nevertheless, there was this tension that I couldn't rectify. And part of me thought it was my fault for the way I acted in Italy. Sometimes my life was challenging and I made it hard on my family, and I really thought it was my fault.
Wow.
Which I think many kids do. Their parents divorce and then they blame themselves.
I'd like you to find me one who didn't. I mean, I can't tell you how many parents have asked me what's the best way to, you know, help my kids because we're getting a divorce. And, you know, the obvious one is please make sure to tell them over and over again that what happened was not their fault. But there is another part of it that is almost impossible to avoid. And that's that if a kid starts to put things together, if mom or dad could stop loving each other, what happens if they stop loving me and they don't want to be with me? Will they abandon me? So, you know, that's not often said out loud, but it's certainly something that a lot of people grow up feeling, is the temporariness of love. And it's very, very painful and anxiety provoking.
It was interesting. I recall my mom telling me always we're still a family. And I said, Bryce is my brother. Bryce, you and I, my mom, are not a family.
Right.
That's not a family. That's, you love your sons. A family is when two people love each other enough to bring kids into this world or adopt.
Right.
It's a unit. It's not the same when you're separated, despite your best intentions and wishes. And I honestly used to throw blame onto both of them, but then I realized that was a poison I carried around with me. And if you'd asked me at the time what was my greatest fear, was that I didn't have a family. And I really felt like after that day, I had a brother, I had a mom, I had a dad, but I didn't have a family.
So how'd you cope with that, Cole? What was your strategy for kind of making it day by day?
I think I was very goal-directed and always had a vision for the life that I had. Being the third Peter, I felt an obligation. My father went to Syracuse, first in his family, to go to college. Went to University of Ohio at Akron for law. I always felt like I must do better than my father.
Oh, okay.
And not in a way in which I am trying to beat him in any way. But if he did that, then I could do more because my father didn't grow up with the same means and access
right.
as I had. And so who would I be to not seize the moment and do my grandfather well?
And when did the emotional struggles begin?
Well, so I made it into Cornell.
Okay.
Which was incredible. I felt very proud. I was doing my dad one up for sure, yeah. right? He went to Syracuse and then I went to Cornell.
Right.
And there was a certain amount of pride that went with it. I think there was a certain amount of intellectual arrogance that came with it as well, a better than kind of experience. I was did very well. I was second in my class in high school. And if someone didn't do well in school, I did honestly think, are they a little slow? I'm more intelligent. Ha, ha, ha. Karma comes back so viciously sometimes. But there was a less than or an othering I would do to some people. And I remember I'm not going to speak about my family members and their struggles. I think this is about me. But my brother went through a challenging time, and I wasn't there for him. I didn't understand it, and I wasn't there for him. And so nevertheless, I get to Cornell. I grew up loving American Pie and Van Wilder and Animal House. And so I was very inclined to join a fraternity, as my father had. He was a Sig Op at Syracuse. Second I got to school, I wanted to know what the most fun club was, and they said rugby. So I joined rugby because you party and wow. you play sports, and it was brutal. Did that. And then I went up to the people I thought might know where the coolest quote-unquote fraternity was. Again, a young guy just looking for community. I wanted to rebuild a family. That's why I wanted to be in a fraternity or in a sports club, was I wanted to have an identity in a family. I wanted the support of a family, and I thought a brotherhood could do that for me. And it was also fun, right? You dress up, you play yeah. games, the girls come over, there's different parties and formals uh-huh. and pomp and circumstance and rituals, a secret society quality. So I ended up at Alpha Delta Phi, which was the antithesis of my upbringing. It was Deerfield, Andover, Packer Collegiate, Horace Mann, all of the private schools, East Coast private schools, people, old money, new money, but largely old money families, very elite fraternity to get into. It was Teddy Roosevelt, Supreme Court justices. Our home was built by, I had no idea at the time, Teagle, which is Rockefeller, Standard Oil built our home. So there was a 16-sided building on our hill with no windows or doors, a passage into it. Anyways, I was social chair because I thought I wanted to run parties, and I'm social chair again. Then I'm Beastmaster, which means I win the wrestling contest. And then I'm the Songmaster. And again, it's these accolades and titles and positions. And so anyways, it culminates, and I'm getting around to the bipolar stuff, but it culminates with senior year. I'm turning 21. I became president of my fraternity, which was the ultimate honor. The presidents of our house, I could name them 10 back. And I went to Europe to celebrate my 21st birthday, and we got a boat from Budapest to Amsterdam. And I was pretty darn arrogant. I was pretty selfish. I wasn't selfish with my fraternity or with friends, but I thought of myself before others. And if someone had a struggle, whether that was a drug problem, it was lack of self-control. If they had a mental problem, like there was a fellow who took Seroquel at my fraternity, yeah. and I was good to him, but I didn't say something when guys were cruel to him because he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. I didn't let him talk to me about it, and he hid it.
Right.
And that was something I didn't think was great about my fraternity, which was everyone had to be tough. I mean, maybe you talked about a girl leaving you, but in general, you didn't bring your problems to your friends.
Right.
Because people were not kind, really, or open-minded. It was all about good things. So I turned 21, got on this boat, Budapest to Amsterdam, with my father. And nevertheless, long story, it's a very long story, but I was having a great time. My father had a health concern or something that at least I interpreted as a health concern. And nevertheless, I missed the boat at one point, and I got stuck in Germany without a phone that worked and without money.
Wow.
Or at least access to it. And so what I did was I got to Amsterdam, which is where the boat was going to go, in the matter of a day, just relying on the kindness of strangers, hopping on trains. And finally, I thought I had one train to catch. I went to like Copalitz, I think was the town from where the boat was, on a train, wandered around to the docks. I was, maybe the boat would have stopped in Copalitz on the way to Amsterdam. It didn't. And so I was like, oh gosh, I got to get on a train to Amsterdam. Get on the train, happened to make it to Germany. And then I missed the connection by seconds. I get there, our train was late, the train just disappears. So I started crying because it was in a field. I was in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. There's nowhere to sleep. It was getting dark, and this Turkish fellow came over, the only person, and he goes, what's going on? I'm like, oh, I feel like, I don't know, my dad had this kind of health thing, and I'm not sure what it was, but I interpreted it as, you know, he's frail, and he may have, not frail, but his heart health might not be good. And so nevertheless, I was driven to go see my father in Amsterdam and rectify the situation that had been caused. And so he said, I'm a good Muslim, I'm from Turkey, you need to go there, I'll drive you.
Wow.
And so I said, really? I don't think I can pay you right now. He goes, don't worry about it. This is what a good Muslim does. You look after people. And he starts telling me about jihad, which is the internal struggle. It means submission, the internal submission to Allah. And he was Turkish. He was Shia, which is the kind of more mystical. It's not Sufism. But nevertheless, they followed Ali, and we had an amazing drive. He sang the Quran. He told me all about his life history and his family, dropped me off in Amsterdam. And I didn't want to stay at a, I didn't want to be alone. I'd had a lonely experience. And there was something too, and I'm getting to the bipolar, but there was this life lesson I learned on that experience where I had some cigarettes with me. That's all I really had is currency. And this fellow came over. I could tell he was Roma, which are typically known as gypsies. He said, can I have a cigarette? Sure, you want to talk? Absolutely. Sit down. He's Spanish Roma. And I've always had a fascination with Roma culture, with their origins. They have very interesting musical traditions. They also have an inclination towards the mystical and the magical. They have an amazing mythology. Each caravan has their own unique eccentricities. And so he told me about his life. And then he said, and I was having a bad day, but I still had a family. I still had access to money. If my cards worked, I would have a phone if I could get it working. And he said, my kids, we just lost our apartment. I got laid off that job right there. That's my family. I can't feed them. Can you get me work? I said, all I got is a pack of cigarettes. And he said, can I have it? I said, yeah, sure. Of course. You've had a way worse day than I have. And my day had been unfortunate. I was very bummed out about my father. I was bummed out about my situation. And anyways, he said, are you serious? And I had the whole conversation in Spanish. Hablo español casi bien. I learned it growing up at Crane and traveling to Mexico. I lived in Mexico and I always liked the opportunity to speak. And so anyways, he said, can I have the pack? I said, sure. And he goes, are you serious? You're going to give me a Roma, your whole pack of cigarettes, all you really have? I said, why not? He goes, hold up 1 second. So he takes me into the subways and he points out this guy. He says, do you know who that is? I said, I don't. He goes, that's my godfather. He's the king of the gypsies here. He says, has anyone done you wrong in the last 5 days? And there was a fellow on the boat that had really screwed my dad over. I'm not going to speak poorly about people, but he really caused me a lot of hell for no reason. He worked on the boat. Resentful, bitter, cruel. When I wasn't getting along with my father, he wouldn't even give me internet vouchers just to snuff me. And I mentioned, well, there was this fellow. He goes, oh, really? Do you have his name and address? And I said, no, I don't have it. He goes, do you have his phone number? I said, no. I said, why are you asking? He goes, oh, because you gave me the pack of cigarettes? You've been the kindest person to me in days. No one looks at me even here. I work for nothing. I'll have him killed.
Oh, my God.
I said, that's really kind of you, but I think I need to keep going. He goes, oh, my name is this. Here's my phone number. Anytime you need anything, he goes, you have the backing of the room. So I learned this interesting lesson about how kindness can get you so far. And I'm thinking of my grandfather. Finally get to Amsterdam, meet this guy. It was his birthday. And I finally got access to the money that I had, which was quite enough to do well. And so he and I spent the whole day. Well, evening into the next day awake because it was his birthday. And then when I finally went to sleep, I'd made it about 700 miles just by talking to people. There's many other incidents. I went to sleep and I had this dream and I've never had one since or one before. Dreams are interesting and we can talk about them. You know, Jungian dream perspectives. There's many different ways in which we can introspect the state that lies between deep sleep and waking state and where that is and where it takes you. But I had this brilliant, bright white light appear to me out of the cosmic void. And it was very profound. It was as if it was Godhead, but it was very kind. No faces, no nothing, just blinding bright white light. And it said, did you see what you accomplished and who you met and what you know? If you could go through that, you could achieve anything. You want something, you got there. Now, with that knowledge, you must be a role model for children. And then it said very emphatically in this cosmic enigma that was to dissect and destroy in many ways, hopefully purify my life. It said, be yourself, and then vanished, and I woke up.
Wow.
And I took that to mean a blessing from God to be whoever sure. I thought I was as a 21-year-old.
Wow.
And I immediately woke up with emotion like I'd never had before. It was the emotion I had prior to my parents' divorce.
Oh.
I could genuinely love people and love things.
So it was a very healing experience.
Well, it was, but it was also... how do you deal with emotions? I think that was the tipping point. That was pretty much when I got the gift of bipolar. That was the experience. Because with the ability to feel and sense very, very, very deeply, you're sensitive to other things. So nevertheless, I, prior to my experience with this God message in a way, that's how I took it. I don't have God as a person or a thing. It's like this primordial awareness that loves you.
Right.
It's like a magic wall of goodness.
Sure.
And I believe I'm part of it. And so nevertheless, I wanted to be a banker prior or a lawyer or something corporate and ritzy, take over the family real estate, go to parties in the Hamptons, work your way up to high society parties. I mean, I'd been at them just having gone to Cornell. And then I immediately realized I want to be a painter and a poet and a sculptor and a singer. And I always idolized Hunter S. Thompson amongst Bukowski and Joyce and Blake. And I took that message to mean help everyone you can, show them experiences, but also don't let anyone judge you. And it gave me this profound confidence. So then I traveled Europe for about a month and a half. Amsterdam, Barcelona, Madrid, Ibiza, London. And I really thought I was blessed by God and my ability to speak in iambic pentameter from time to time. I mean, most people would DSMize it
yeah,
as hypomanic.
Okay.
And it was incredible. I bought a kimono the second I got out of that dream, wandered around Amsterdam in a kimono. People thought it was incredible. I met all these people by wearing a kimono.
Okay.
And I told them I was writing a book because I was The Agony and the Ecstasy, The Agony and the MDMA, which is a play on Michelangelo's book, right. The Agony and the Ecstasy. And people loved it. And I had a big bank account to go anywhere, anytime. And so you have positive encouragement, but you're riding high. Like I was not sleeping as much as I should because I knew that death was imminent. My father has his health problems. Death could come any day. And so at the time, I didn't think anything was odd with it because I was quite the character in college. I wanted to be a legend where people talk about you once you're gone. There were those. Anthony Joseph Drexel Biddle IV, Charles Patrick Tilly Denihan, Paulo Andrew DeFreitas Rust. I mean, I could go down the list of guys that were revered. I wanted that. And so I didn't know the fine line between pathologized mania, whatever that would be called, pressurized speech, proclivity towards not going to sleep, whether that's a dopamine rush or it just didn't cross my mind because I'd never been diagnosed with anything. And so sure. I got to the Hamptons to continue the party. And it got to the point where people were asking for my autograph, thinking I was already famous or was going to be, which was baffling and also encouraged the hypomania.
Sure.
And at the time, there were no delusions of grandeur outside of the fact that if you really believe in yourself, you can accomplish things. So it's twofold. I never said I am famous, but I said I will be famous and that my book will be a success.
Right.
It wasn't like I am Christ in any way. It was none of that stuff. It was just a real deep, I mean, if God met you and said, you're going to be really successful, if you could do that, you can do anything, naturally you go, wowzer.
So it was quite euphoric in some ways.
Profoundly.
Yeah.
for the whole time.
Which is a very common description people have when they're in a hypomanic episode.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember I was gifted a song from the universe when I was in London. It just showed up, the whole song. And it was, it goes, I was walking through the streets, head looking at the ground, peer up at the sky, searching for some blues, just feeling the sound. So talk to the birds and sing to the trees and know that the sky is all part of me, part of me. I never thought like that. Right. Prior, I could read, tell you the whole song, but it was so weird to be tapped into this frequency in the ether that an entire song manifested when I had just a tiny piece of paper, just big enough to fit, and a pen on me.
Right.
And I went, oh my gosh, I want to be a musician. And so with that comes the debauchery of, you know, who did you like, right? Do you want to be like Jimi Hendrix? Do you want to be like Pink Floyd? Do you want to be like the Stooges and Iggy Pop? Loud personalities, self-destruction, indulgence in certain psychedelics or conscious expanding agents. And so nevertheless, I ended up getting institutionalized while being in New York upon receiving. My friends didn't know.
Wait a second. How did you end up in a, you know, psychiatric?
I was having lots of loud music and people over at the place in the Hamptons. My father showed up hearing from the people that run the community. What do they call them?
Oh, okay.
Homeowners Association. The president was adjacent, our neighbor.
Oh.
And I have American flag bandana on all the time and big sombreros. And so I'm wearing silk pink pants
trouble.
With psychedelic kimonos and people over and
yeah.
Consuming alcohol in the front yard. And they just didn't know what it was. I had a nice sports car. And I really thought I was, there's a great Hindu story where an Indian guy turns to another one and says, hey, I just found out I'm God. And the other Indian guy goes, I'm glad you found that out. And so I really thought that not that I am God in like a maniacal megalomaniac way, but that I have that divine spark and I was feeling it. So I got institutionalized because my friends took me to the hospital. My dad showed up. He said, are you using drugs? I wasn't. He asked to drug test me.
Right.
Because he's like, how could you be like this? And I was so upset because he didn't recognize my brilliance and what I'd been through in Europe. I didn't tell him any of the stories. I just got to him in Amsterdam. And I'm not proud of this. Only time I've done this in my life. But I took my crab sandwich and threw it at him. At a nice restaurant. I said, you know what? I'm not going to swear on this, but you know, F you.
You can say whatever you like.
No, I don't need to, but it was one of those real, I said that, F you, and anyways, I hitchhiked home, and my friends were like, what happened to your dad? And I told them, and they knew my dad's like my role model. I don't speak poorly to my father, ever. Right. Wow. And they were worried, and they're like, hey, so the kimonos and the silk, I mean, I had a collection of kimonos at my fraternity. I bought a bunch in China for all the guys. These were wild dudes, but they said, Cole, something's not right. So they took me to the hospital. The first doctor to talk to me asked me if I was hearing voices. And I said, are you hearing voices? What are you talking? I had no idea how you get at the hospital. When you get to the hospital, if you're acting out of line, they ask you that. And if you're confrontational, I just lived a summer of opulence. And now this woman who I don't know, after talking to me for seconds, asking if I'm hearing voices, said, are you hearing voices? Yeah, I am hearing voices. Your voice.
Yeah.
Who are you? And the building was dedicated by Andy Tisch, who was a family friend of one of my best friends. And I said, I know Andy. I've met him. Who are you? Write your name down. And she's like, I don't have to. And I said, you know, screw you. You do. I'm going to find out who you are. You're not doing this to me. I was like that, getting all kind of like Gambino on her.
Sure.
And she put in an order for me to go to the psych ward in Queens.
Wow.
And so then became that was the most humbling experience of my entire life.
And what kind of, do you remember the medicine that they put you on?
They initially put me on Seroquel and Depakote.
Okay.
Depakote is a mood stabilizer. It's used for, it's not, well, mood stabilizer. I mean, it's an anti-epileptic.
Yeah,
cocktail.
But it does work for bipolar.
They don't even know why, really, though.
They don't know why most medicines work, I think. So
I found that
that's
troubling.
Not unusual. Did it work?
I mean, at the time, if I was to check the boxes on the DSM, yes, I had pressured speech, but also I'm in a box and I'm told I'm like the guy, my roommate who was schizophrenic and decked someone in the face when they were on the phone too long. Right. I mean, violence was normal. I'd never been in an environment like that. I never had a roommate who screamed at night about the devil. And,
oh, God.
But, you know, I like the guy. His name was Lorenzo. He loved Tribe Called Quest. When I got food brought, like popcorn, I'd always give it to him. It opened my eyes to the fact that you can be on the other side of the fence.
And how long were you in this facility?
About a week and a half, which is quite typical. It usually ends up being anywhere from it's almost mandatory 3 to 14 days. I've never been longer.
And then that's where they came up with official diagnosis?
And I told them, I said, honestly, it felt like I was being deposed by various powers that be at some Nuremberg trial.
Right.
I said, honestly, if you'd lived the summer I'd lived, you would feel unusual. I mean, let me show you some of my poetry. Can you write this?
Yeah.
The level of depth in it? And I could tell you them. I don't need to brag, but I have them. I was lucky to have a very good memory, so I had a lot of them memorized. I just didn't feel appreciated for my experience. No one had the time to listen to the whole story. And so they told my family I needed to go to a place to get better. Oh. So that was the first treatment center.
And where was that?
Silver Hills in Connecticut. And so the second I get there, they gave me a dual diagnosis, which they give most bipolar people. If you say you've consumed any substance ever,
they were concerned you are a drug addict on top of...
They give you that label whether you are or you aren't. I've had tons of friends just get that one. I don't know why. I mean, I was at a place that was a rehab. It wasn't for people with mental illness.
Oh, okay. So everybody's classified as having a substance issue in a place like that.
Well, or you have anxiety or depression or attachment issues.
But you hadn't had a depressive episode at that point.
Because I never had anything to be depressed about. I mean, I was at that point very driven.
Yeah.
And I wasn't about to let anything get in my way. I don't have a propensity towards dwelling on the negative. However, with this curse and blessing, they said, you got to take pills for the rest of your life. And I was like, there has to be someone who says that's not the case. Because I was like, that sounds terminal to me.
Yeah.
And there's nothing terminal about what happened. It was an experience. It was enlightening. I got my emotion back. I actually find things I care about. I was able to like have a deep connection with women, something I had a challenge with.
Yeah.
I did have girlfriends essentially, but I didn't feel a deep connection to them probably because of my mom's lie way back when.
Yeah.
And so, but I met great people. Of course you don't name the names of the people in treatment, but yeah, I met some beautiful girls who were just so kind. One of them, they were all from the city, had these great long stories. My roommate was a super, super famous producer who'd just been hitting the club too much, I guess. I mean, Grammy award-winning producer. We became tight. And I just felt profoundly misunderstood and didn't understand the system I was being put in.
Well, it's good that you didn't understand it because that means you didn't have much experience with it, but it's sad that that's how it all happened because it sounds like you were caught very much by surprise.
I was, and when they said you're bipolar, I went, I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't think I even knew. I mean, Fight Club, the guy's like multiple personalities. I'd heard about that, and I heard that Churchill was bipolar. I heard that Abe Lincoln was bipolar. I'd heard that William Blake was bipolar. Whatever that means, like you are bipolar. I don't know if I believe in that. I'm definitely not defined by a couple checked boxes. And that's a label. I mean, I'm Cole.
Right.
I sometimes exhibit symptoms that are not only socially acceptable, but contrary to the norm. But that was created by a bunch of people that typically don't have mental illnesses, again, quote unquote. So anyways, I felt profoundly categorized, misunderstood, and upset. It led me to take a semester off of school.
Oh, okay.
They didn't want me going back. I needed to heal. And that's when the misery really set in. Because I'd prided myself on my academics. I'd been a leader of my fraternity. I'd been the party guy.
So your identity really got shaken.
Everything I liked in myself,
yeah,
I had to question.
And what were your parents? How were they coping with you?
No one understood what it was. I was just sick and needed pills forever. And none of them had experienced me hypomanic or manic. So they'd only heard about it, and then they read about it. I don't know if they even read any books about it. It was just that, like, I have a mood condition, which they didn't know what it was. So it was just hypervigilance, essentially. Don't do this, don't do that, don't drink coffee now, and don't have green tea. And I went from having total freedom and the knowledge that I would be, well, in college, I knew I'd have a great job. I work hard. I'm somewhat bright, and people like me. I like most things.
Yeah.
To don't do this, don't do that. Did you take your pills? I started to go, I'm not really sure why I would. If this is my life and I can't go anywhere without these, it's going to be very limiting. And then the guys from my fraternity, not many people called me. Hey, how are you doing? It was like Cole's crazy.
Yeah.
I remember thinking back to this girl I knew from high school who went to Stanford. Brilliant. She's going to be like president of the United States one day, I think. She's just so smart. I heard she had ended up in the woods at Stanford writing in a notebook, and they found her thinking she was Jesus. And I remember thinking, oh, crazy her.
Right.
And that whole mentality, I got to sit and contemplate almost all the instances that I'd been like that to people. And I kept on telling God every night. I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Can you fix this? Can you fix this? I didn't want that. I'm sorry I was cruel. I even wrote out a lot of it. Ways, places I went wrong that could have brought me this. And so as time went on, I went back to school, got off my meds, ended up hospitalized again. And now I'd had an episode at school.
Oh, okay.
So now people got to see the hypomanic, manic Cole. And it's intense. I think there is an energy. I think everything's vibration. I think everything's energy. Anyone that looks at quantum physics would suggest that.
Yeah.
Right? Tiny, tiny, tiny little things that are vibrating on a Planck scale. And people can sense it. You could speak slowly, but they can still feel the intensity of it.
Yeah.
And so that episode, they have themes. That was the episode where I wanted to be a rapper. So the poetry turned into rap, and I wrote all these rap lyrics. And they were actually pretty darn good. A lot of allusions to cool things. I still have them. I've collected. I never have thrown away any of my notebooks because I was always trying to go, where did it go wrong? I also started during each episode once I realized I was in it, burning myself with a cigarette in different places. And I could point them out because I wanted to remember what went wrong.
Yeah.
Not for pain relief, not like someone would cut themselves. It was like, I need to figure out this Rubik's Cube.
Wow.
And I know it's possible. And so as time went on, I graduated. I had the manic episode, but I still got good grades. I didn't lose my priorities.
Good.
And I graduated. I went to San Diego, and then I was off my meds in San Diego for a whole year. Didn't have any episodes.
Cool.
Well, and we were partying all the time, frankly, and I don't mean nothing reckless, but my buddy wasn't working. Everyone had graduated. So I was pretty much hanging out at the beach in La Jolla, going to Pacific Beach. It was really fun, and I had no mental health problems. Then I moved to Australia for a really great job with a fellow who was South African who owned a healthcare products company that he was turning around. He bought in the red and wanted to put in the black. Within a month, taking my meds, I had another episode.
Wow.
And I'd gone there thinking I'll go for 4 years, establish myself, and go to business school. So again, alienating people at work, hypomanic. People are concerned about me.
Yeah.
People who really like me when they first meet me.
Yeah.
There's a love-fear thing to it. And I will say this podcast is on fear. If you said, Cole, what's your greatest fear? I would have said a life sentence of me never knowing when the demon's going to show up. I'm waiting for the... And it's not a demon. I mean, there's many great elements. And at this point, having been through as many episodes as I've been through, I don't fear the episodes.
No.
No. I fear the fallout. I fear... I've had friends of a decade and a half. Something happens. They see this side, and then they never talk to you again.
So they get scared and run away.
And then people that just heard about it don't talk to you. And no one asks, how are you?
Yeah.
It's like the ultimate taboo. Schizophrenia and bipolar, I'd say. Schizoaffective, for what it's worth. Never understood that diagnosis. I don't really... Schizoaffective, so sometimes you have mania and you have delusions, but some of the delusions linger. That's the thing about delusions. They're just thoughts.
Yeah.
And then sometimes when you're hypomanic, it's like a thought pops up, and then you put a little bit of conscious focus onto it, and it like blots out, like expands into this beautiful cornucopia of other thoughts that you're kind of like a monkey swinging from these branches to branches. And at a certain point, one of the branches, it's not stuck to a tree that has roots in the ground, and you kind of vibe on it for a moment, and now you're living in a universe that's not the universe of our consensus reality. If there was a whole island filled with us, maybe it would work.
Yeah.
But it's hard to function in a society that's so rigid in a sense.
So how are you living your life now? In the interest of time, we got about 10-15 minutes left. How are you living your life now in the present day?
Well, I can tell you about all the amazing things that I've gotten into. Without bipolar, I'd probably be an investment banker.
Okay.
Working a 6 to 10 Friday through Saturday, climbing the corporate ladder. I realized that was a hot pursuit for nothing. I've had so many things lost. I only value the things that I care about, which are God, and not the God necessarily of the Christian church, the notion of something that loves me infinitely no matter where I am.
Right.
That always, God's like a magnet of goodness, and he's always attracting me. And I would talk to him frequently in places where I was alone. I spent a lot of time ostracized. So I have a daily prayer practice.
Good.
I pray throughout the day. I have my mala beads on me. I have my own little personal mantras from, you know, Om Shreem Kleem, some Hindu mantras, bijas. Uh-huh. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. Psalm 23. I mean, I studied sacred texts extensively to see if there was anything there. And I learned a lot from it on how to be happy and the overlap, the perennial philosophy. I watch my sleep. I have people in my community, my friends on my phone, my mother, my brother, my father, my grandmother, that I say, hey, look, if I'm going off the deep end, sometimes they do it ahead of time, right? Because my personality is naturally demonstrative, a little Italian like that. So sometimes I'm actually just in great spirits. Okay. And they're like, we're worried about you. And I'm like, why? And then they give you some reason. I'm like, that's not a good reason. They're like, you've said that before. I'm like, I swear to God, it's not a good reason. This is, I'm excited. So it's really, you have to develop this almost Jedi-like ability to be aware of yourself.
Right.
Like, is that a thought that I should write a song with? Or is that a thought that glues me into some action that I'm going to perform? And I'll be honest, sometimes I have crazy thoughts, and then I just take more Seroquel, or I take more olanzapine, and I tell my doctor. I mean, I try to be honest and open with the people that help me. I don't hide things.
Well, so part of what you're describing, just to be really clear, is that you try to be as aware of all the different aspects of who you are as possible, rather than avoiding your going toward it, so that you can manage it the best you can and be able to distinguish between whether you need to be concerned and whether it's just your normal exuberant self. And I have to tell you, I really admire that approach, because it's not the most common way that people deal with these kind of difficulties. Mm-hmm. Right? A lot of times people become very bitter. And
then you live bitter.
What's that?
Then you live a life bitter.
Yeah, but
you've been given a mango and you keep eating the skin, right? Uh-huh. Some mangoes have way more skin. You peel them and then the skin grows back and you're like, gosh, darn it, I knew there was fruit in here.
But I think a lot of people don't realize they have a choice. And you are somebody that realized very early on that you do have a choice, despite the fact that you're dealing with something that has no cure, only treatment.
I mean, I think it does have a cure. It's that you look for the good in everything.
Yeah, well, but again, it's not going to prevent you from having another episode. if you know what I mean, because as far as I know, and I could be wrong, I have been educated to believe that it's a genetic condition.
I agree, absolutely. Right?
And so far, we're not able to engineer our genes to engineer it away. Mm-hmm. So the best you can do is manage it with as much grace and humility as possible, which is what you're doing. At least that's what it sounds like from when you're talking here, is that you've learned to manage it with grace and humility, and that you can tell the difference between whether it's time to be worried and not. Mm-hmm. And that kind of self-awareness and responsibility for yourself is something that I don't care what a person is going through life with. I think that that's one of the keys, is to take responsibility for whatever it is that we have even the remote amount of control over.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting. I have to contemplate heavily on a daily basis how happy I am. Mm-hmm. When I'm sad, no one really helps you. They can put you on antidepressants. They can talk to you.
Yeah.
So two things. You're not your thoughts. Every thought that comes into your head, that comes from the cosmos in a way. It comes from your subconscious programming. Uh-huh. I think that's something I worked ardently on, reprogramming my subconscious.
Right.
You got to build yourself to be kind to yourself. Uh-huh. You have to also accept the fact that despite your best intentions, despite your best efforts, there's nothing shameful about having a manic episode.
Right.
If you knew what you were not supposed to do, like, look, if you're inclined towards amphetamines, I would tell you to watch out. That's not been my path. But hey, there's certain things that will make the symptoms worse. You know, if you don't count your sleep, and not, you don't have to take notes, but you're like, hey, I got 8 hours last night. The other night I got 6. I woke up early. Well, was I excited for work?
Yeah.
Was it because I didn't sleep well? It just, it causes you, if you really want to live a healthy life, because these episodes can be traumatic. I don't know how many more times I want to go through it.
Yes.
But if I take my meds and I tell my doctor and I ask for help from my friends and I have a relationship with something beyond me that I think inspires me, if I have faith that things will get better for myself and I have a purpose to wake up in the morning, I have a responsibility to adhere to, I know I can go anywhere. And so say I crash and burn again. Well, hopefully I learned something. And I've gotten all these different Phoenix experiences. And by being cast out by many people, I found many others.
And it sounds like you've educated your parents to the point where they truly do understand.
Yeah, some of it was a little intense education. They have to be well close to the furnace on that one.
Don't you think that parents always learn the hard way?
I love my parents. They brought me in this universe. If I could go back in time, I would have been much kinder. There were just moments where, and that's something too.
Yeah.
You know, I think anger, me having to overcome my anger can make you manic. Happiness can make you manic.
Right.
Sadness is like a rebound effect, can make you manic.
Right.
Antidepressants can make you manic. Mm-hmm. Not eating enough, low blood sugar after a while can make you manic.
Yeah.
There's just all these triggers, and you just have to wander around the universe or this planet knowing, oh, that was kind of a trigger. Did that add to this trigger?
Right.
How is it impacting me?
So you become a detective in your own life in a certain way.
I have. It's been like an Indiana Jones mission, to be honest. Because it's the ultimate question is, who are you? And that was what I was going to touch on too, the be yourself. I realized at a certain point, it wasn't be yourself. It was be yourself, like the Atman. Mm-hmm. Be it. Be that which is.
Okay.
Which is that.
Sorry. Do you feel like you've dedicated part of your life to being of service to others?
Absolutely. You feed people, you serve people, you help yourself. And that's what I did sometimes. I'd lose friends somewhere and then I'd just go volunteer. I worked with the homeless for a whole year, just rehabilitating them. You know, I'd find them on the street, get them some food, drive them to the methadone clinic, social security guard, you know how to use Windows. Let's figure out how you use Word and Excel. I had a guy call me from the Dominican Republic who I helped. Saying, hey, Cole, remember you got me that place? You were like my nephew. He's like, my whole family didn't like me, but I always considered myself your uncle, which is funny.
That's amazing.
Because I was the guy that found him passed out on the street.
Uh-huh.
And so I've been so blessed to have so many opportunities and meet so many people. And when you're manic, you're in this headset, you know, mindset. You know, it could be the apocalypse. You think there's this crazy conspiracy. I've been there, and so my level of empathy is huge. And all I would tell someone with bipolar is stick it out. You know, that's my major goal with my coaching business, Mindful Sherpa, is the only way to not solve something is to kill yourself. And if you could just do one thing, whether it's for me or for God or for your grandma, even if you think you have nobody, there's always someone that wants to be your friend around the corner. And so I would just say stick with it, because for me personally, I think if you take that route, you're going to have to deal with it one way or the other. You might have to deal with it with your creator. You might become absolute nothing. And maybe that's where we go. We're like computers that turn off. When I look at the marvelous geometry outside your window in the pine tree, there is this divine intelligence somewhere. And the puzzle isn't as good with less pieces. And I've had many friends kill themselves. I've had many friends overdose. I've had many friends get stuck in psych wards for years. I would just say no matter what it is, you know, and that's the other thing. If you have a family member, talk to them if you can about it. Say, hey, how are you doing? I know if it's not too weird. Hey, I heard that this went on. Just know that I'm here for you. Right. You know, you're never not my friend. I have time for you. And right. Try to be someone that can be honestly non-judgmental. It's hard to do if you haven't been in a situation. It's hard to not judge a person because you have all these preconceived notions about why that behavior is bad. But I'd say be there for them and just say, you can always count on me to be someone you can talk to. When you're in this, if you have a friend in the psych ward, call him. See how he's doing. Call her and say, hey, man, I was thinking of you. Remember those good times? I'm still there for you. And just know that also, too, these situations that show up, I don't think anyone I know with bipolar wants to alienate their entire network.
No.
Over the course of 3 days, piss off everyone you know. And have them permanently see you through the prism of their subconscious as damaged or sick. They're not, you know, and I don't know if you, like I said, you don't want to visit, in this case, France. You probably don't want to live there like I have for short periods of time. So like do read some books. You can get a feel for it.
Yeah.
And just do your best to be kind to the, you never know when you might be that person too. That's what I would say.
You know, Cole, you are a very remarkable young man, I have to say. I am incredibly impressed with your attitude and your willingness to be candid about what your struggles have been. And I think it's incredibly inspirational, I got to tell you. From the outside, I have never really had a conversation with you before until today. And I just think it's amazing how you have been able to come to terms and to come from a place of love.
We all have crosses, and you know, I at least I get to think about mine all the time.
Right.
And I'm sure there's many on there that I don't know and I'll get to discover, but it's really how you carry, we all carry crosses.
Right.
And some of them are stigmatized by the media or experiences.
Sure.
And it's really, how do you carry your cross? I try to do it with grace. And this is the first time I'm being transparent in a way in which maybe the public will see, and hopefully it does some good.
So before we finish, can you just speak very quickly about your coaching practice so that we can give you a plug and tell people how to reach you?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to. I mean, I do it because, and you can read on my site, I do it because I went through intensive suicidal ideation every day for years.
Okay.
Every day that thought crossed my mind.
Right.
And if I didn't believe in God and examine all the things I did and be fearful of hell or at least a bad birth, I couldn't see a good reason in it. There was
it's called Mindful Sherpa?
The Mindful Sherpa, just mindfulsherpa.com. And I look at it as there's all these mountains we climb. Some are Everest and some are the foothills, right? Sometimes you just wander in a field and that can feel like an uphill struggle. And so I figured I could have a business where if you have a drug, alcohol, typically I like working with people about 16 to 28.
Okay.
But I've also worked with a guy that's 46. Who was in a psych ward for years.
Okay.
And he had bipolar. He didn't have the same support as me. And what I do is, no matter what's going on, I'm a voice for you. And if your kid's stuck somewhere, I can go out of my way to go find the person or go hang out with them, whether that's get a hotel room or get an apartment or just help them find the next stop. I'll help carry some of your luggage. And I think in a way in which it's talk. Right? You can call me and tell me anything, and I promise I won't judge you. I'm sure I've met someone that's done something like it, whether you're a murderer or a rapist or whatever it was. I've worked with and been around everything I could possibly think of. Now, look, that doesn't mean I don't have blind spots, but that's what it is. And so I figure out where you're trying to climb and like, hey, I would recommend these boots.
Right.
How have those boots been going? If they're good, don't take them off. But I will say, and whether that's depth therapy or CBT or DBT, IFS, internal family systems, Jungian psychoanalysis. I've experienced most of these. Bioneurofeedback, neurofeedback, yoga. And then I can bring you some of the meditative, contemplative, yantra, mantra, tantra practices. And when I say tantra, it's really just a technique. That's what tantra means. It means a technique of weaving together different practices. Right. Mantras, chanting, and that can be, I am good, I am great, whether it's a gratitude list. Everything works for certain people. Right. And not everything works for some people.
Right.
So what I do is I match you with the best of my ability, what could help you. And sometimes it's just me talking to you. And then other times I turn you over to the best people I can find. And I don't, you know, if you can't pay for it, I don't charge if you're a friend of mine and I hear your story. But I also, you know, it takes some time and energy. And so naturally that comes with just whatever my time and energy could be worth. But my goal and my quote to God was, I said, I'm going to help anyone if I can.
And the best way to reach you is through your website.
Yeah, I would say just check out the website. You can talk to me for as long as you want before you make a move. I'm not ready to get a customer. I'm actually pretty happy with what I'm doing.
Okay.
Customer, terrible word. I'm you know, a person, a client. Yeah, I don't like that one either.
Sure. But
yeah, it hurts me that it has to be transactional.
Right.
I would happily do it at no cost because people have done it for me. And I trained under a guy for a while who was an interventionist who showed me the ropes, became a very good friend, got to see a lot. And I just want people to stick around. This planet's amazing. Sometimes it's hard, but what would be good if there wasn't bad?
Well, I appreciate that. I do understand that nobody gets a life without pain. No one. And I say that to people all the time. Find me one person. I would love to meet somebody who's not had their fair share of pain in the course of their life.
Jay Gatsby experienced pain. That's what I think of, right?
Yeah.
It's 20,000 square foot house. He wanders around alone. I was like, you know what Liberace said? He said, money can't buy happiness, but it's worth a shot.
Yeah. Well, Cole, thank you again so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.